Against Humanity with Adam Brodsky. I am Adam Brodsky, and my very special guest in the studio, Studio B, which is, you know, also the guest room, is Jefferson Berry, an old friend of mine who I have probably known for almost 20 years, and glad that he has so many, so he's a completely different person from when I met him back in the late 1930s, when we were both traveling outside of the Dust Bowl trying to get work in California, picking garlic or whatnot, and then they put us on called us deportees and flew us to Los Gatos Airport, and I was like, but I don't even speak Spanish. And they said, doesn't matter, get in the... And I said, hey, Susie, guys, that's what you get for singing Woody Guthrie songs before they've been written. So anyway, so I am just mumbling here, but we're going to get to Jefferson Berry directly, and he's going to tell us a story and talk about his new record, Jefferson Berry and the Urban Acoustic Coalition, with its really great logo, which will be on the page when we mention it. So, Jefferson, hi, nice to see you.
Hi, Adam. Wow.
How are you doing?
We've arrived, man.
We've arrived.
And this is the first interview I've done for this record.
Well.
Fantabulous.
Good. Well, as you can see, the high quantity, my headphones broke today. So that's how we're rolling. So these are going over here. So good. The first interview for the new record. What's the name of the new record?
It's called Guitar on the River.
Okay. And how's that name come about?
I come down out of Fairmount, out of my neighborhood, and go down to the river and just throw songs in the river, you know?
Okay.
The other one is of course, Ned's River up there, the Unami Creek.
Yeah, the Ubangi.
Yeah, the Ubangi. You get up there and, you know, just as the river goes by, just toss songs into it.
It was like Arlo Guthrie says, I used to believe that songs were just in the river for you to go fishing for, and the only thing you had to do was not try fish downstream from Bob Dylan.
He failed at that.
Yes. So this collection... are there any old gems on this new record? You got stuff that was hanging around in notebooks?
We redid Listen to Me, partially because I wanted to give Bud Burrows songwriting credit on it.
Okay.
And I remixed it and made it nicer than it was on my previous album. But other than that, they're all pretty new.
Okay. And the record previous to this was called?
Fairmount Station. It was the album that I did with my daughter Brianna.
Right. Now Brianna sang on this record as well, too, didn't she?
She sings a little bit on this record as well.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then before that, what was the one, the big 32-page color booklet back in the George's Fifth Street days?
The 1999 release of Urban Acoustic.
Okay.
Which, it's an interesting record. It's, it was the onset of the digital age, right?
Right.
So this was done.
It's a fad, I tell you.
It was done on ADAT tapes, these metallic tapes. And I recently wanted to go back and like remix them, and they had all got salt on them. Yeah, they've pulled the salt right out of the air. And
really?
Become, yes, and they're all ruined.
I didn't even realize it because I've got ADATs in a Tupperware in the other room. They're gone.
I did too.
Oh no.
Yeah.
Well, there goes that recording of Hookers and Blow we've been looking for.
Right.
So, but let's now go way back. You are a California kid, right?
I'm a Californian. Uh-huh.
You were born. Now,
I wasn't born there.
Oh, you weren't born there.
No, I wasn't born. We moved out there in 1967 from the East Coast. My father was an itinerant advertising guy.
Okay.
And we moved to Los Angeles in 1967.
From where?
Connecticut. He'd been working in New York, and he moved us out to Southern California, where he'd been born in Southern California.
Okay.
So, you know, it was a return home for him.
Okay, and your mom's still alive. She's you just moved her back here, right?
Actually, no, she's still out there. We tried to move her out here, but she wouldn't have any of it.
I don't blame her.
Right. We brought her out here during the winter just to, you know, to give her a taste of...
Oh, okay, I thought she had come.
Yeah, she didn't. She was going to try it out for 2 months, and she lasted 8 days. Yeah. So, just as well. No, she's still out there, and, you know, I don't have... I love going back to California. It's a great place to visit, but I wouldn't live there again.
Okay. Why not?
It's very busy there. It's very expensive there.
Yeah.
And people... I love Philadelphia.
All right.
You know, people got your back here.
Okay.
I got real genuine... kind of folks here, and I don't think that the genuine quality of, there's a lot of nice people out in California, that genuine I got your back salt of the earth thing.
Now, when you lived in California, where did you live?
I graduated from the University of California at Santa Cruz.
Banana Slugs.
The Fighting Banana Slugs. And we got my career started in the rock and roll radio business in San Francisco.
So, okay, so what station were you working for?
I was working for KML, which now is an R&B hip-hop station, but back then was the rock station in, okay, in San Francisco.
And so what year is this, roughly?
This is 19... this would be 1981.
Okay, so 81, so you're a kid. You in your 20s or 30s?
Yes, I'm in my 20s.
Okay.
And I'd come up from L.A. I was, you know, my folks lived in L.A. County, so the west side. And so I was sort of a beach bum sort of hippie.
Okay.
And after graduating college, I was like, you know, working, you know, short order cook, migrant farm worker kind of jobs.
Right.
And went to Los Angeles and got into the business. And when I went up to San Francisco, got into rock and roll radio.
Okay, and you were selling airtime.
Yeah, selling airtime in the early 1980s.
So tell me what that, like, so how much, like we were talking before I turned on the microphone, the way I envisioned that era is I call it the mountains of cocaine era.
It was ridiculous. It was ridiculous. We would be, everybody at this radio station, it was kind of like just, you were expected to have an 8-ball of coke with you at all times. And in fact, the business manager at the radio station was everybody's dealer. And she would come around, you know, if you needed a little bump in the afternoon, she was there to give you the little bump. She was also there every 2 weeks with your paycheck and enough cash to cash it less what you owed her. Everybody in the station had a $1,000, $2,000, $3,000 a month cocaine habit.
It's like a company store, only with coke.
Oh, it was bad. But some of the situations, you know, the Eddie Money's, the Journeys, the, you know, backstage at the Police, you know.
Right.
It was like early 80s was pretty popping time for that corporate rock type
now,
of thing.
Now, what was the, in San Francisco, what were the big clubs? Was that the Fillmore and...
Well, the Fillmore was still open. The Keystone was a pretty good club there for touring bands. The Mabuhay Gardens was the place where it was probably the most popular punk club. My favorite punk club was the Deaf Club.
Okay.
So named because it was so loud.
Right.
That deaf people would go there to feel the vibrations. Off their chest, you know, bands like Black Flag and
right.
The Dead Kennedys and stuff. So,
so you must have seen absolutely everybody.
It was a good time. You know, the whole Jefferson Starship orbit.
Now, were they still living in San Francisco?
They were still there. They still had the mansion there on
right.
Fulton Street. The whole Dead thing was still very much in play. Although at that point, Jerry was, you know, on his decline. But it was very, very interesting times.
All right.
The whole lifestyle of just gallivanting up and down, carefree, you know, very few responsibilities.
I get the feeling that even when you do that today, it's not the same as it was back then with no email and actually being able to hitchhike and relying on the kindness of strangers.
Very, very, very different time. And I teach high school now and I tell my students, you know, it's like, you know... 99% of the people that graduated college with me were computer illiterate. I didn't have a television in my house until I was 7.
Huh.
Nobody did.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's so much technology that have completely turned our lives, our music inside out.
So now your family, I know you have a brother. I know your brother, Hank. Do you have sisters or anything?
No. Just Hank,
the two of you.
Just Hank and I.
Uh-huh. Okay. And, you know, as much of a hippie as you are were, I mean, you know, you look like a button down compared to your hippie brother Hank, who lived in a friggin' teepee.
Two sides of the same coin. No, he's the genuine article. He really is.
I love that guy.
Me too. He's something else.
Yes, and also one of the smartest individuals I've ever been in a room with.
Me too.
Yeah,
no question.
Yes. How did you get out of California? What happened next?
They ran me out of town, basically. Yeah, at a certain point, I'd been in rock radio in San Francisco for about 5 years.
Okay.
And I'd gotten married. I had had a daughter, Aaliyah, who mm-hmm. you also know.
Yes.
She's been raised with Uncle Adam at the various festivals.
I love those girls.
Yeah. And we moved east and eventually settled here in Philadelphia. I had a brief stint with a radio station in New York. it didn't work out, but came down here and started working for WYSP right before the Howard Stern Show.
Okay.
Came to town. It was the first Howard Stern simulcast.
Yeah, right. This was the first city other than New York.
And I totally took that show to the bank.
Okay.
Yeah. The whole Howard Stern thing was really, changed my career, because then I went on to consult radio stations around the country.
Oh, really?
On their Howard Stern problems.
Oh.
Went to San Diego, Grand Rapids.
As a consultant or to live?
As a consultant. Cleveland, Rochester, they would fly me in for 3, 4, 5 days, $1,000 a day, to talk to them about, the fact that their salespeople were apologizing for the Howard Stern show. You can't sell stuff that you apologize for.
Right.
So then, and the reputation got around. And other stations hired me, Miami.
Wow.
Flying around working with Howard Stern radio stations for a while there.
Okay, so you were working with stations that simulcast Stern, telling them how to sell ads on the Stern show.
Not with the Howard Stern show. They were very, against me, because they thought I was exploiting them. And of course I was.
Well, wait, so you were working, you were a consultant.
The stations would hire Howard Stern for a ridiculous amount of money.
Right.
They bring a show on, and then they wouldn't know what to do with it.
Okay, so you were helping the guy in Miami sell local ad space to Herb's Miami, the Mattress King.
Correct.
Okay. Oh, I see. And you were telling him how it's done. And the Stern show was not did not want you to do that. They felt that you were sort of stealing a piece of their pie?
Kinda.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you were?
I was.
Okay.
Sure. But I'd go in there and say, well, why won't the Cleveland Symphony Orchestra buy time on your show? That's right. The demographic that buys symphony tickets. And as soon as the symphony did, they've found direct results off it.
Okay.
Which was kind of surprised everybody, including me.
So you were sampling the cocaine all around the country?
No, at that point we were really sort of laying a little bit lower on that. I mean, the president of the United States in 1981 had his tongue to the rail. Everybody did, and those are different times.
Uh-huh.
Very different times.
All right, so. So that was, now, when did you, now you were a radio ad salesman through when?
Well, I got tired of it after a while. I went to work for Power 99 for a while. I worked at, for Pyramid Broadcasting at an adult contemporary station here in town. And
now let me ask you a question. Selling radio time, does it matter, you're a rock and roll fan and a big music fan, but I wouldn't think of you as a Power 99 R&B sort of fan. Does that matter when you're selling the time? Could you sell?
Oh my gosh. I mean, one, you're really just selling an audience and not really selling the product. But at that time, this was the height of the Boys to Men thing.
Right.
The Whitney Houston thing. I mean, there was a lot of really exciting R&B coming out at that point.
Oh, okay.
And I was totally into it.
Oh, okay. All right.
It was as fun as any rock station I ever worked with. And the crazy thing was, that would get me down into places where I'd be selling advertising to people that, the salon that was doing hair extensions right next to the right next to the chicken shack, right? All cash up front,
Right.
It was got me into parts of neighborhoods in Philadelphia where people like me don't usually go. So Lime Kiln and Stinton.
And where were you living in Philadelphia at that time?
I was still up in Ambler.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, I was still up in Ambler. Moved down, I started my own ad agency, moved into Old City.
Okay.
And we had some interesting times down there as well. But after I sold the ad agency, I went to work for KYW News Radio for about 9 years.
Actually. Oh, all right.
So.
And what's that like, selling ad time with no music? Is it a different crowd?
Lucrative.
Really?
It was pretty lucrative.
Okay.
Yeah. But KYW was a very good station. It was about that time that, I was really getting my music thing on and really starting to put together some good music. Working for a big company like CBS, particularly at that point, it really kind of took the fun out of it.
Okay.
Back in the day, I'd go... I go over the Keystone and write commercials for them, and then he'd give me cash, and we'd, you know, have a few drinks, and, you know, and it was a lot of fun. And at the end, it wasn't like that at all. There was a lot of accountants involved. And, yeah.
They sucked the fun out of it.
They really did. Oh. They really did. Although I still have a lot of really dear friends there, and you know, I think, you know, KYW really serves a purpose here in town.
But so eventually, your job became like a lamplighter or a buggy whip maker, right? I mean, it's just
we were selling widgets.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's just not a job. I mean, what there's 12 guys in the whole country
now? One of the things is it's a young person's game.
All right.
You know, at a certain point, you know, it became a little unseemly for someone my age to be doing it, and now I'm a high school teacher and I'm facing that again. You know, where you know who does this at this age?
Well, you became a high school teacher like 5 minutes ago.
6 years ago, actually.
Is that? Are you serious?
This is my sixth year.
Holy shit! Because I just remember. No, now when did you get your master's degree?
About 6 years ago. Yeah.
I helped you write that. I edited that paper for you.
That was before.
Was it the 70s? When was that?
You're right. No.
Holy shit!
Yeah, it was 7 years ago. The whole Ben Franklin thing.
That is
was
fucking
7
crazy.
Years ago. Yeah.
Because it was a great dissertation. I learned so much about William Allen and Ben Franklin and all that crap.
Oh, I'm a history junkie.
Yeah, you were always a history fan, and you got your master's degree from?
Temple.
From Temple. Mm-hmm. And then became a high school teacher at the, were you in your 50s or 40s?
Yes, 50s.
Which is crazy to start a new career in your 50s. Those are some big old balls, dude. I think that's noble and respectable and ridiculously scary, wasn't it?
I don't know. It didn't have a lot of choice on it. Didn't have a didn't really, could no longer do the ad game.
Right, okay. Know?
I had finished putting my kids through college, and I was really done with it, you know. Really, the last 10 years of my advertising career, I mean, it was strictly about, like, you know, putting food on the table for my kids.
Okay.
And because it wasn't cool anymore. It was a safe distance from cool.
Okay.
Yeah.
And now you're the spokesmodel for Clean and Sober. How long have you been sober?
About 19 years.
Holy shit.
Yeah, not the spokesmodel, but we're totally grooving to it.
Yeah,
great way of life.
And here's the thing that truly amazes me is you are still a giant music fan. I mean, not just a player, but like a friggin' fan of music.
Uh-huh.
And you are a fan of the music community, and you know, and you're always at the shows and you're always at the festivals where people are doing all sorts of stuff for you. And you handle that with aplomb, and I imagine
you always see me with a guitar in my hand.
Yes.
Right? So, like, I got a real purpose for being there.
There you go.
You know? And really, you know, with the people there that are, you know, expanding their horizons, so to speak, you know, I give them a little soundtrack for that. It's never really been a problem, although I can't explain to you how.
Okay.
Because it should be a problem, and it's not.
I imagine it would break your heart if you couldn't go to those things.
I mean, we were having a custody Thanksgiving last weekend, and this is where you get the kids for the weekend. And even though my kids are in their 20s now, they say still, like, you know, it's still like the custody Thanksgiving. And my youngest, Brianna, who, you know, I made a record with, she just goes, I don't know anybody, like, who likes to play as much as you do. People ask me to sing, and I say, stop bothering me. That's what she said. Me? No, I'm always right.
Always, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you played last year at the Folk Fest.
We did, yeah.
You guys played on the camp stage for 2 hours or something?
2 hours
set. It was like the goddamn last waltz up there.
It was awesome.
30 or 40 people join you? 17 people?
It was great. There were 17 performer patches with that show. Yeah.
That was amazing.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I sat in a chair for 2 hours and watched all my friends play up on stage.
And the thing is about the Urban Acoustic Coalition is this coalition of musicians that I've come to know here in Philadelphia. They, you know, they sit in for a song or two or maybe half a set. And, you know, some of them, but play with Bud Burrows. I mean, he's certainly, you're not going to have him sit down. The guy's just too good.
No, Bud is amazing.
But, you know, they'll end of that show with the people from Boris Garcia just blowing the top off the back end of the set. It was just a lot of fun. I've never had more fun playing ever.
Oh, really?
No, that was the item.
So, and that sort of fits into your model of the Urban Acoustic Coalition. So explain what that is.
The idea here is, like, I've had all kinds of these different bands and different projects, and you go through all this effort, you know, as you know, with branding these things. And, you know, and then somebody leaves the band, and now it's now, I got to start all over again and do something completely different. And the idea with the coalition is to get really good musicians. All these musicians have projects of their own. So the idea is I'll clear a date, we'll rehearse songs for that date and with that set of players, and it's a great show because they've got great players. You know, to have people in a band and demand all their time at a certain point that gets old for just about everybody.
I sort of like the kind of Woody Guthrie communist attitude that has. It's just like two each from their ability.
Right. Well, I call them up. I say, clear the date. Don't clear the date. It's cool. You're in the band if you decide you're in the band.
Right.
And at this point, I have enough people that know enough of my material that they'll come out. And if you want to play a set, I have a show coming up at Steel City where my good friend Jay Popke is going to be joining us.
Yeah.
It probably happens before this podcast airs, but, you know, Jay and I are working up a set, and his band, Sonoma Sound, you know, is playing a lot around town and drawing great audiences and getting great opening opportunities for national touring acts. You know, the idea that Jay would be in my band is not that, you know, that's not really happening.
Right, but he can show up for a night.
But he can show up for a night. We can work up a set and have a blast doing it. But Burroughs is in, you know, several bands. Brown's in several bands.
Yes. It's interesting to see this grow out of, because I remember the first one you made from 1999. Remind me the name of that
The
one.
Urban Acoustic Record.
The Urban Acoustic Record, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was, I remember you did a 32-page color booklet, and you took me aside and said, listen, I put all my friends on a page in this goddamn book, CD, if they all buy one, I've just sold 32
there. Yeah, so. Yeah. As somebody who makes CDs, you know that all those friends didn't actually buy it.
Also, CDs were a lot more expensive to make back then.
And people bought them back then.
Yes, and people bought them, yeah. So, but I love the idea. It was just like, you know, I'm going to put all my friends in. And then I guess, so it seems to me like this is a progression out of that.
Actually, no. This the next band that I had was called Hippies and Hillbillies.
Right.
And it was sort of Jerry Garcia Goes to Texas kind of cover band. And I had a couple original songs that I wanted to be growing into the next project. But the banjo player quit, you know? Now,
wasn't there a Jesus freak that wouldn't play Friend of the Devil with you? That story cracked me up for
a moment, yeah. In the early parts of it, yeah.
That made me laugh. I refused to play that song with you too, but for different reasons.
No, Beth Mead and Ron Ward and Bud Burroughs were in that band. And it was like the musicians. They're phenomenal musicians.
Oh, yeah.
Right? But Bud was going off to join Boris Garcia.
Yeah.
Ron Ward needed really a lot more touches a month and plays with a variety of folks around town now. And Beth Mead, you know, she's just, you know, the best banjo player you could ever imagine, you know, and she had all kinds of offers to play. So I go through this big effort, a phenomenal t-shirt, the Hippies and Hillbilly t-shirt.
The t-shirt was amazing.
The t-shirt was great.
A great shirt.
It was a great shirt and a great brand, and in the end, I put all this effort into the brand, and then it just sort of went away.
Yeah.
This Urban Acoustic Coalition is going to be the last thing I ever do. It'll always be the coalition, because I love being in a band.
Yeah.
And, you know, the players will come and they'll go, and it'll still be the coalition.
Nice. Why don't you play us a song from the record?
Okay. I will. Here's the one that people are playing. I guess we're on about 40 radio stations of this right now. And this sort of goes to the idea that there's messages to be told,
right,
in a lot of my songs. But you sort of have to balance that with what people want to hear. You know?
Yeah, I know.
And so I have these dark, meaningful kind of songs that I think have messages that must be heard, of course, right?
I know the struggle.
This is what people work all week for. called Born on Payday.
Yeah, I like this one.
Late, born into a blizzard, I came on cold on a Friday night, way upstate. Oh, mama, she leaned by the front door, waiting for my dad to arrive. Oh, intermittent breathing and being annoyed at what was taking him all this time. For the team, born on payday,
born on payday,
Friday the 15th. Yeah. Oh, now daddy stopped on his way home, just his paycheck. The liquor store took my mama and a bottle of Dirty Bird to the hospital maternity ward. They said, "Ride this way, young lady. Mr. B, you'll have to wait here." So he opened up a fresh pack of Lucky Strikes and settled in.
We are here with Jefferson Berry, the front man, the head of the Urban Acoustic Coalition, whose new record is out. And you can get it. Where can you get the record?
You can get it on iTunes. You can get it on jeffersonberry.com, CD Baby.
All the spots.
Amazon, all the good places.
Good.
Yep.
So now you are, you're a gigantic baseball fan. And you're a gigantic Roberto Clemente. You've got that awesome throwback Roberto Clemente jersey.
Right. When I was a kid, we lived in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And, it was during the era of Roberto Clemente.
Right.
And working in an all-white, living in an all-white steelworkers neighborhood. If you were a fan of the baseball in the early 60s, in that kind of a neighborhood, you were rooting for Bill Mazeroski or Don Hoke. Dick Stewart, one of the white players.
Okay.
You know, being a little white kid, you know, rooting for the Don Clendenins or the Roberto Clementis was not so much the way to go. He's a fabulous, fabulous player. And my earliest memories of baseball were watching him.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, and you know, we talking about that in those times, and I get to talk a little bit about this with my history students in high school. Like in the early 60s, not only was the technology there, but the utter lack of tolerance in our society for anything out of the norm. I mean, Protestant kids couldn't go over and have dinner with Catholic kids in the neighborhood I lived
in.
As a Unitarian,
were you a Unitarian back then?
Oh yeah, I was born a Unitarian.
Oh, okay,
sure.
All right. So you've been clueless since jump.
Yeah, from jump. Being a Unitarian back then would involve my parents dropping us off at the church for Sunday school when they went off to this place called the Gazebo to drink Bloody Marys and read the New York Times. That was Unitarianism in the early 60s.
So one of my favorite jokes, if you want to commit a hate crime against a Unitarian, you burn a question mark on their lawn.
Yeah, right. Well, we would have black friends from the church or from my mother's school or, you know, come over for dinner and stuff, and everybody would be out on the front porch. Like, who's going over to that house?
Oh, right.
And the black friends would come over, you know, packing. You live where? We'd love to come over. You live where? It's funny, too, because when we went back, you know, many, many years later, that neighborhood now, all black.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Interesting. Okay, so you... when did you live in Pittsburgh then? Is that before L.A.?
Before L.A., yes.
Okay, so Connecticut, Pittsburgh.
The early 60s. Then out, okay. No, Pittsburgh, Connecticut, and then gotcha. Out to California.
Okay, and so you end up here, you like it here, and then after you left radio, now you get this job teaching. Tell me about what you teach.
I teach for a school that's privately owned. They have a contract with the Philadelphia School District for overaged, undercredited youths.
Right.
Which is basically kids who are basically the last stop where they've never quite fit in where they're supposed to.
So this is hard.
It can be, and they go through, apparently it's not for everybody. I love it though, because for a large part of this population, they've never had this intellectual spark.
Right.
You know, they've never had anybody that really cared about them enough to give them a good show day after day.
It seems to me like you seem, I'm just, from what I hear and what I gather from the periphery, but you seem like such a perfect fit for that gig, being able to get all smart with people that no one has ever thought were or could be smart.
I mean, it's like kids coming in off the corner, you know, from slinging the rock till 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, kids getting shot and killed occasionally.
Yikes.
You know, the young girls coming in with their first, second, or third child at 17 years old.
Oh, it's a co-ed school.
It's a co-ed school, okay. Sure. Oh, you're not going to get any guys to go to school without the girls there.
Okay.
When do you go to high school? You go to high school for the girls, don't you know? But we provide a really safe environment for them to come to school, and a lot of schools in Philadelphia are really not that safe.
Right.
So half the kids there are the troublemakers, and half the kids basically stopped going to the high schools because they weren't safe to go to. They need a safe place to go.
And you've got you told me that you know, you've got your bouncer on speed dial. If shit goes down, you can press a button.
It's a behavioral model that comes. It's modified off of a reform school kind of situation.
Okay.
These kids are not at that level. We do run schools. My company runs schools that are at that level, but they're there to confront behavior, and we keep run a pretty tight ship.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now you've been here, you say, 6 years?
This is my sixth year teaching, yeah.
So you have you got any success stories, guys that are out there turning themselves around?
Dozens and dozens, sure.
Good
you
for
know,
you, man.
Kids coming in with, bad legal problems, bad GPA problems, and coming out of our situation with, with a sense of purpose and becoming, EMTs, going on to a 4-year college, becoming accountants. We have far more car mechanics than accountants, but people do,
Living's a living, man.
Living's a living, and having that focus with our postgraduate strategy that they come out of the school with, I think most of them follow through with it. We graduate like 85% of
really?
Our kids. Yeah.
That's got to make you feel pretty good.
Yeah. No, it's very rewarding. It doesn't pay well.
Yeah.
Because there's a war on teachers in this country.
Ugh.
We're basically, we got to blame somebody. Can't blame the parents because they're the voters. And can't blame the administrators because, we all work for them.
But also, charter schools seem like a money grab from the top.
And frequently they are,
yeah.
And we are a cost of, we're an operating cost.
Right.
Teachers are. But, I don't really even care so much about that, and I don't bitch about that so much because every day I go in there, and you just can't make this stuff up. The stuff these kids come up with, it's just crazy.
You got something?
Conversation we're having right now on the 14th Amendment.
Okay.
With the court decisions coming down on gay marriage.
Right.
And what a polarizing issue this is. For high school students, inner city high school students.
Okay, go on.
Certainly know something about discrimination, and yet, you'll have half of them saying, oh, these people are just second class citizens, or, all the things that that people say about young black teenagers.
Right.
The black teenagers say about the gays. And and we turn around, and then there's a gay population in the school saying, wait a minute. I'm gay, and I'm wired this way. This is just the way I am.
Okay.
And I provide a classroom experience where they can hear that from the first time straight from the horse's mouth.
All right. You think you're changing minds?
Certainly providing an experience where that happens. Minds change when people are open.
Okay.
And bigotry is not necessarily, it's something everybody has to fight against.
All right. So.
And my kids are no exception to that.
But. Here's something. One of my first memories of you is we camped together at Falcon Ridge for a bunch of years.
Yes.
And we would camp down in the flatlands.
Uh-huh.
Which, other than the fact that sometimes you're up to your knees in mud when it would rain, which was every day.
Every day.
it was. I really liked it down there because you'd go up the hill and hang out, but then you had your own. It was like commuting. You got
right.
to go back home at night and get a little privacy. And I loved we ended up being the 8H campground. Because it was hookers, hicks, and heebs, hippies, and hillbillies.
Hank.
Hendricks, his daughter.
Hendricks and Hornbostel.
And Hornbostel. There's eight. There they are.
Right.
So, and that's where I first met your daughters.
Right.
And I remember vividly, I remember meeting Brianna because she was 14 years old at the time. What is she now, 28?
26. Oh, no, she just turned 27.
27. Yeah. I'm going to split the difference with you. So, and she was 14 years old, laying on a lounge chair there, reading The Color Purple, which is not your basic 14-year-old reading. and she was, and I was, in my 20s, and I was not a bit of an asshole. I was an asshole. I was young and angry, and I was convinced that I was mad at everybody whose songs weren't like mine, especially those people who were having more financial success with them. And I thought, well, that is an injustice in the world that you get to be on a stage and I don't, because my songs are better than yours. So anyway, that's my own thing.
Yeah.
And so Butch and I would just sit there and be Butch and me, and we would piss and moan and
hysterical.
And it was funny. It was funny.
Oh, really, really funny. You and Butch Ross. I mean, endless amounts of fun.
It was a really good time. But the thing I remember is that, you know, this was an not safe for work show, and you know, because we would not hold back, like, anyway. But even more so at a folk fest when we were dirty and felt free, and especially at Falcon Ridge, where quite frankly mediocre music, no one will argue with that.
No.
The mediocre music from the main stage is coming at you, and so we were usually in rare form in front of these little girls. And what to everyone's credit, the girls and you were just like, the harmless guys. They mean well. They're good guys. They actually have some salient points once you flense away all
right.
The
and people would say, are you really going to expose your daughters to Adam Brodsky? It's like, yeah, well, if they have a question about it, they're going to come to me about it. And they would from time to time, but by and large, they you know.
And I love those girls. Every time I see them, they were both at the Folk Fest this year, at Philly Folk Fest.
Uh-huh.
And I saw them, and they are both doing such amazing things. Like, Aaliyah is up in, she's teaching in Newark, right?
Well, actually, she ended her teaching career in Newark, and now is getting an MSW at Rutgers, working at a women's shelter for young girls that they are too old for foster care.
Oh, wow.
But too young to get out there in the real world. And so she's becoming a caseworker.
But she's in the shit there. She's every
totally,
day. Like,
she's a soldier.
Yeah.
For helping the disadvantaged.
A little too Jesus crazy for me, but she's such a good person. She's like one of the three people I let slide on that.
She's, you know, she has really found a path of that. And this mission that she has, I mean, she just dedicates herself to helping people every day.
Yes. And I read her Facebook posts, and they're inspiring and heartbreaking.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's pretty wild what's happening at the bottom of our society right now, and it's easy to ignore.
Yeah,
and society does as much as they can to block your view from it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, and there's people down there doing amazing things, and she's among them. Yeah, you know, I'm very, very proud of both of them.
Yes, and Brianna, what's she doing?
Brianna works for she's developing video content for the internet for a company that has large corporate accounts. So she has a relationship with, Palmolive, Crest, Cadillac. Her reel at this point, her video reel, is really becoming pretty impressive. PayPal. She's done a lot of really, really interesting stuff. She was traveling around with the Pepsi AC guy at the tailgates. Around the NFL, they were flying from one NFL
season
to another, doing Pepsi AC commercials at tailgates.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And I also, I heard, I'm probably going to mess up some of the facts, but the key fact is Shakira said she needed her?
She did a Crest shoot with Shakira, and they sort of, you know, they sort of got an affinity there. And so Shakira had a Crest gig that she had in Barcelona and requested Brianna to go on it.
Oh, that must have sucked.
On like a second's notice.
Oh, nice.
For 2 weeks, yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, no, it is.
Good. That's got to make you feel proud.
It does. And the deep, dark secret there is that Brianna's the better singer of the two.
That's funny. Your daughter can sing for serious.
Oh,
yeah.
For serious.
Yeah.
We did a show the other night at the World Cafe Live.
Yes.
We've been doing a lot of, one of the main singers in the Urban Acoustic Coalition has been Irene Lambro, and she had a band called Medea for 6-8 years, something like that. And she's been singing with us. We've been doing a few of her songs. She's been doing the Brianna parts from Fairmount Station.
Right.
We've been coming up with new things to sing together. But in this show, she had her own band. Out and asked the Urban Acoustic Coalition to play this gig with them.
Nice.
And so I asked Brianna to clear the date. She cleared the date. She came down. We did some rehearsals. And she's to sing with her again is really, God, it's really fun.
You got, yeah, you're on stage singing your songs with your daughter. Like, that's as good as it gets, right?
You see a lot of people doing it, though. And the fact is that, you know, I mean, it is fun playing with your daughter, but really, being on a stage with Bud Burrows, Brianna, my bass player, Dean McNulty, who's just excellent, Dave Brown, who's, like, just scary intuitive.
Yes.
With the way he plays. And David Rappaport, who I mean, for a long time, I just didn't get along with drummers, you know? And here's the drummer who's really, he's like, he's so, I mean, he's so right. We're so right together.
Nice.
So, yeah.
So is this your this your favorite band, this core? This...
Yes, it is.
Cool.
This aspect of it's great, but if I can't clear Bud Burrows' schedule, which he's as busy a musician as I know.
Right.
Or Dave Brown, for that matter, with some of his gigs. If he's got a gig with Psychobilly, you know, that's been booked before mine. You know, that's fine. You know, I'll put together some other stuff. We played the variety of gigs with other folks. So
that's great. What is the minimum that you think you'll show up with that you'll still call it the Urban Acoustic Coalition?
I haven't hit that minimum.
Okay.
Yet. I haven't hit that minimum. I have thought about that. But no, I would show four people.
Okay.
And call it the Coalition.
Cool.
Yeah.
So the record came out and you're doing radio promotion like the big boys, like the grown-ups.
Yeah, kinda. Yeah, I am. Well, one of the things about this record is it's really kind of a rock record.
Okay.
And so it doesn't necessarily fit into that non-competitive folk area.
Right.
Rock and roll, rock records, it's very competitive. And to get really the AAA stations on it, would probably cost me more money than I have.
Yeah.
So, yeah, between now and Christmas, we're putting together this little campaign, see how high up the Americana charts we can go.
So what's the single?
The single is Born on Payday.
Born on Payday. Yeah. So you call up your local radio station and you request Born on Payday.
Yes.
And there, I assume your webpage has a list of stations that have it in rotation?
Doesn't yet, but we've only been out for 3 weeks.
Okay, well, this podcast is going to post on December 15th. So by then, I guarantee you, Jefferson Berry, what's the website?
It's jeffersonberry.com.
Jeffersonberry.com will have a list of radio stations, if he's good at his job, hopefully with phone numbers and email addresses and Twitter accounts,
right,
where you can tweet and say, play this song from this new artist that I heard. Yeah. Guys, sounds like he's an 18-year-old phenomenon.
That's it. That's me. 18-year-old phenomenon.
So play us another one from the record. Or whatever you want.
Well, we did a different arrangement of this song. This is a song that that Brianna and I did on the Fairmount Station record. She sang lead on it and did these really like wild, lofty leads. And Dave Brown on this song, this version of the song, plays this dark kind of dobro slide thing, and it's really one of my favorite songs on the record. The Brianna version was so hopeful, and this one is just not. Tune.
Of course, I insist.
Jim Boja wasn't doing this. Some of your podcasts have been just, I mean, really funny.
Well, thanks.
I mean, people, if they like this one, they should check out some of the others. Very, very entertaining.
Thanks. Yeah, this has been a blast having people up in the studio.
So this is called about like the working dead, people that are working just to I don't know, it's the endless thing called sleeping in public.
All right.
Outside the scenery, just roll on by. Little hits on the train track. As he opened up his eyes, where were you just now? He asked himself, trying hard to remember the dream and how he felt. Then he looked around to see who was there on the commuter train. Did that it had been a hard day and he was whipped, fighting the shame of sleeping in public. Nicely framed photograph hangs on the wall in the living room of a suburban home. It's an image of days gone by, reminding those he loved. He was more than normal, he was more than enough. Bad luck in the markets hit him one day. Left his family with bills they couldn't pay. From lost to loser, he let it all slip. Now you'll find him downtown, sleeping public. Ooh, 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 ooh. Sometimes you'll take a break, sometimes the break takes you. Of modern living in America, it's true. You don't have to fight, but you can never quit. End up overwhelmed and sleeping in public. Made the connection on the Broad Street line, Fairmount Station. Beneath the city street, only for a moment, their eyes had a chance to meet. The broken broker who had come in from the rain asked the commuter if he could spare a little change to replace this bottle of Night Train Express. I know what it looks like, I'm just such a mess. But just like you, I'm no stranger to success. No one would blame either of us for sleeping in public.
Sleeping in Public.
Yep.
And that's on the new one.
That's on the new one.
Okay. Now, was it on Fairmount Station?
It's also on Fairmount Station. The hopeful version's on Fairmount Station. The dark, you want to die version is on
my friend,
Guitar in the River.
A bunch of early Warren Zevon records have like the same, like Poor, Poor, Pitiful Me is like on just about every one.
Right.
And my friend said years ago, he thought, well, Warren was probably just so drunk, he just forgot what songs were on which record and just put them on again.
I think, you know, and people don't do this that much, but I think that you can do the same song on more than one record and have it come out really differently.
Dylan put two Forever Youngs on the same record.
That's right, he did.
So, I like this one, I like that one. Which should we go with?
Yeah, no, well, put them both on.
Put them both on. Put some one song in between. But
I know. Isn't that crazy? What'd you think of that when he did that?
I thought the same thing. I think when well, first of all, I was five when he did it, but when I heard it, I thought the same thing. I always think is I thought you can't do well. What? I guess you can do that. One of my biggest musical epiphanies, and this is such a dumb aha moment, but Bob Dylan's 115th Dream. I was riding on the Mayflower when I thought I saw it. I was like, when I first heard that, I was like, wait, you mean you can write a song just about something like that? Which is just such a dumb thing to not be able to think for yourself.
Right,
but,
sure.
But as soon as he did it, I was like, oh, wait, I guess you can. And literally, changed my world. I was like, well, then I can write songs about whatever the fuck I want.
That's exactly right. You know?
And so that's
and Diesel Dyke was born.
Indeed. Indeed. So now let's talk. The only person we have not mentioned in your beautiful world is your wonderful wife, the vicious lawyer. The shark.
Blue eyes.
Yes. Now, so how long have you guys been together?
We will have been married 14 years in February.
Oh, wow. So yeah. Nothing's new, man.
No, she's fabulous. It just keeps getting better and better.
I'm crazy about her. She's fantastic. And what I find interesting about her is she is not of this world. She is not of the folk music world.
No.
She's not of the music world.
No.
She'll come to the festivals, but at a distance with a hanky and goes home mostly.
Well, yeah, and she loves the crowd. You know, to a point.
Yeah.
There's a certain point where they get kind of silly. But it was interesting when Brianna and Aaliyah were first coming in. The whole stepmother thing can be dicey.
Yes.
You have young daughters, particularly. And she really did an excellent job of not being a daddy hog.
Okay.
They just really let things evolve in their own sense of time. And, you know, and as a result, they've really grown to love and respect her. They turn to her with a lot of stuff that they won't turn to me with. I mean, she's really there to mentor them. But when Brianna and who is like a total music head as well, when she was at a certain point, they were painting her room or something, and Brianna asked Barbara, said, "So Barbara, what kind of music do you like?" And Barbara said, "I really like silence." Yeah, right?
Yeah.
And there's just like, okay, that's nice. Can we just, you know? And in through her affinity for silence, I've come to appreciate silence. There's moments where I turn the damn radio off and, you know, I drive in silence, something I would never have done without her influence. Yeah.
So, honestly, though, if you're downstairs strumming in your basement, she ever come down just to listen to you play?
Not often.
Yeah.
No.
And okay, and that's, I mean, because I've dated both kinds of people.
Right.
I've dated the ones the girls who sit with their arms at their sides, look up at you, and mouth every word, and that's awesome. And then I've dated people that I don't know. You feel like, well, she actually loves me for me, not just whatever she sees.
Right.
The accoutrements of my
yeah,
career.
I don't know. I mean that adulation. You know, I'm a certain age at this point, and you're getting there.
Yep.
For that starry eyed, you know, youthful. Oh, I mean, you know, that's why we started playing guitar.
Yeah.
For sure.
Uh huh.
I mean, you know, it was about the chicks.
Yes.
Sure. But not anymore. And there's a double, in my basement, I put double drywall on the ceiling, so no sound is emitted there at all, right?
Sometimes if I'm playing downstairs, I come upstairs and there's a door at the top of the steps that we never close, except when I practice.
Then
she closes it.
Sure.
And right. I tell her, you don't like my guitar? She says, oh honey, it's not the guitar, it's the harmonica.
It's the harmonica.
So, so and she's a trial attorney, right?
Yes, she is.
And you tell me, this is sometimes you'll come to me and you'll say, you want to go see a baseball game? Barbara's in her dark place. Like you tell me that before she goes to trial, she gets honed.
She really gets focused, and she's so sweet, so generous and loving, and tell you mess with her in some kind of case. And if you're not really playing with all the cards, you know, as you know, if you're dealing off the bottom with her, she's really gonna. Oh, she's vicious. Yeah.
So is that?
I mean, and then I become the trial husband. I fix her meals. I stay out of her way.
All right.
You know. But it doesn't happen that often, actually. In our society, you know, our litigious society, things don't really go to trial that often.
They settle 90-some% of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
And you are also a gigantic. Have you've been to? You're a huge baseball fan. So have you been to all 30 parks? All
no,
how close are you?
I'm at 26 lifetime parks.
Okay,
but a bunch of those: Forbes Field, Shea Stadium, the Kingdom. A lot of these don't exist anymore.
Right.
In fact, I don't actually think the Busch Stadium I was in is the same one. But yeah, no, I've tried to get to a lot of baseball parks.
Okay, and then and you and I, we go to a couple of minor league games a year.
Yeah, sure.
And it's like it's funny. You tolerate the minor league, but baseball, you're like, yeah, you enjoy being outside and having a pretzel.
Yeah, no, it's fun and it's nice. And you're going down to Wilmington now, right?
Yeah,
you're
I'm a season ticket holder.
You're a season
Blue
ticket
Rocks.
Holder, and I'm not a season ticket holder of anything anymore, which is a little unfortunate. But
well, you score the rich people seats once in a while.
I do. I as many as I want, man, because really getting rich people seats down at Citizens Bank Park is not that hard anymore.
It's fun. You take me, we're like 19 rows off the field by the third baseline. Yep. Those are great seats.
Those are great seats. Yeah. You know? It's a nice day.
And then, you know, when I go, my seats in Wilmington are, I put my feet up on the dugout.
Yeah. Do you find kids to give the scorecard to down there?
You know, yes, we do. You taught that to my bass, to Jim Taggart, my drummer slash baseball buddy. Uh-huh. And he does that, except if he wants to get an autograph. As a matter of fact, he got an autograph from Terrence Gore, who was playing left field for the Blue Rocks in April and May, and was stealing bases for the Royals in the World Series.
Nice.
So I mean, because the Royals are such a small market team, it's a straight shot.
Yeah,
and
sure.
And so we looked it over of the players on that roster, on that World Series roster. We had seen over the years, I think it was 8 or 9 of them.
It's really funny how baseball works like that, because I'll be down watching the Lakewood Blue Claws.
Yes.
And I'll watch somebody like Singleton, who now I guess is in the Astros.
He's on the Astros, first base for the Astros. Yeah.
First base for the Astros. When I saw him down there, I said, this is not a major league ball player.
Really?
He's supposed to be a hot prospect. So when I'm watching minor league baseball, I have no idea. I've become convinced I really don't know what I'm looking at.
Well, with those qualifications, you could be the general manager for the Philadelphia Phillies.
I guess
Ruben
so.
Amaro doesn't have any clue
he
either.
He doesn't have any clue either. It's a shame, though. But they're you know, 5 years from now. We'll be
yeah, when they buy, I mean, yeah. Don't get me started. they should ditch everybody. Cole Hamels and everybody. Yeah. I mean, there's no point in keeping that.
Back.
And especially Cliff Lee. My boyfriend deserves better. They should send him on his way and let him win somewhere.
Back up the truck.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. And pay the Cuban.
Yes.
Pay the Cuban.
I agree. So. Well, we will see. So your record available, Jefferson Berry. You got anything coming up between the 15th and the 30th of December?
Actually, I'm playing a Unitarian church in Moorestown, playing my Christmas hit. The song, this is kind of an interesting story. Where I lost a fight with Irving Berlin.
Go on.
Even though Irving Berlin's been dead for 40 years.
Yeah, but he's Jewish, so you're going to win that fight.
Well, you're so true.
Okay, how good a lawyer your wife is. Her name's O'Connell.
This song I wrote, a Christmas song, I'm thinking, man, if I could get a Christmas song to hit, you know, that's a paycheck every January for the rest of my life.
Hell yeah.
Because once they start playing them,
right.
They continue year after year after year.
The license to print money, yeah.
So I've written a 2-minute and 42-second Christmas ditty, and in the middle of it, I interpolated.
Ah.
Interpolation, huh? Interpolated White Christmas.
Right.
And had it all recorded with Brianna, actually. And we went to Irving Berlin's publishing company.
Harry Fox or?
No, his publishing company.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, and they said, go fuck yourself.
Pretty much.
All right.
Pretty much. And I said, I'll give you points on the thing. No, man. White Christmas, we make a lot of money on White Christmas. And I kind of thought it was like public domain. So I had to rewrite the song, and I wrote the White Christmas out of it.
Ah. Oh.
So, but it's still a pretty good song. You want to hear it?
Sure, for my podcast. Play a Christmas song on my podcast. This is what good friends we are.
How many Christmas songs do you have on any of your podcasts?
This will be the first and last.
Nice. Leave in town for Christmas on a plane that's taking me home. Going there cause they miss us. And fuss. This week really was too much. I had to tell the boss I had surely had enough to be leaving town for Christmas. connection in DFW. I'd love more time in Texas, but I'd have been spending much less time with you. And with all the rush and fuss, the stores try to make a buck, and all the cars are stuck trying to get home for Christmas. Rust. Oh, because we're leaving town for Christmas. The old friends and the family, lots of hugs and kisses, and gifts under the Christmas tree, like that Robert Earl Keen CD. You know, the one with Merry Christmas from the family. For me, you shouldn't have.
That's cute. That's nice.
You know, and 2:42.
Bada boom.
Bada boom, yeah.
You get in, you get out, nobody gets hurt. Yeah.
Yeah, and somebody who might not play my music otherwise, you know, our good friends at WXPN.
Yeah.
I'm really confident they're going to play that. This Christmas.
Yeah.
So y'all get out there. This broadcast comes out on the 15th. I want y'all call XPN and say, leaving town for Christmas.
Leaving town for Christmas from Jefferson Berry and the Urban Acoustic Coalition.
That would be the deal. I have all my Jewish friends call.
And we carry the clout.
Yes, you do. Right. Yes, you do.
So let us do this. JeffersonBerry.com, the new record, all the good stuff. Come see him around town. You have, once you get, obviously, the three best things about being a teacher are June, July, and August.
Unbelievable.
And so you plan to do any sort of regional touring?
Well, we're going to go after the markets that have played the record.
Right.
And be getting out there in the spring, looking at New England a lot.
That's a good place to be.
And we got friends up there who would love to come out and see us. So
yeah, so if you're listening around the country, contact Jefferson and tell him where he should play and see him out on the road with his Urban Acoustic Coalition.
Give us a couch to sleep on.
Yeah, and give him a couch to sleep on. He's one of my respectable style friends. You wouldn't know it, but he's wearing a goddamn sport coat today. so he's looking truly legit. So why don't you take us out with something? You could anything you want, but if you want to play the Train Robbery song, that would be awesome too. Because these are relatives of yours that robbed this train, right?
Oh no, this is, water in the well.
Yeah.
My great-great-great-grandfather was pistol whipped by Jesse James.
There you have it.
And looking it up, this is like an old story, but actually found the news article in the Des Moines Register that had coverage of the story, eyewitness account from somebody who was staying up in their attic, who watched the whole thing go down. And then I correlated that date with this series of bank robberies that they were involved with. So,
all right. Yeah, so I love the history of that. And also I helped him fix this song a little bit, the meter.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, you absolutely did.
Yeah.
Let's see.
I mean, if you know it.
I guess.
You could also just play whatever you want. So,
oh, my God. There's like 25 verses to this, and with having not rehearsed it, and not having it in the
Is it on
right
the record?
Now, it's not on the record.
Okay, so come out live and request it. He guarantees, Jefferson Berry guarantees, if you come out to the show, he will play it flawlessly.
Why didn't I think to come in with that song ready? Because you were so valuable to me on that. Oh, my God. So, okay.
Whatever you want to take us out with, whatever makes you happy. But the name of the song, the train song is called?
Water in the Well.
Water in the Well.
Yes.
Okay. And this one is called?
Actually, I think I'll give you the, one of the things that we do a lot is play other local songwriters' stuff.
Yeah.
And you know this from the Fairmount Station. You came in and helped us sing.
I did. I sang on this record.
On the Miles Thompson song. And this song has a Skip Denenberg song on it. My Hippies and Hillbillies record had a Ben Arnold tune on it. Because there's so many good songwriters in Philadelphia and people friends of ours. I think it's important for us to play one another's songs.
Here's the dead truth about Jefferson Berry. Jefferson Berry is always there at your CD release party, and he always buys your record. And you try and hand it to him. He's like, no. And he hands you money. And Jefferson Berry buys your CD release, buys your records. And he's a great supporter of the scene and always has been. Yes. I remember more times than I can count seeing your face in the crowd and seeing your $10 or $15 in my hand.
Yes, it was a nice thing, right? Yes. And then there's that whole section, like in my CD collection, which is, it's like I take the old stuff out and put in local stuff and
nice.
It's becoming really more local. But this is a song that's on the new record, and it's a great song by Skip Denenberg.
Yes, I love me some Skip.
Yeah, so...
Skip Denenberg, by the way, is the reason that I got to open for Kris Kristofferson, because Skip would have been the opener, but they forgot to call Skip.
How about that?
He was out of town, and that's why I got the gig, so I'm always grateful to Skip. I just saw his beautiful wife, Anne-Marie. I saw her cruising through the streets of Philadelphia last week.
How about that? You know, and I met Skip about the same time I met you at George's Fifth Street Cafe.
Yes.
This is a song he wrote with Joey Wilson right before he died.
Oh, right.
My name is King Midas. I married Mona Lisa. We're here on this trailer park. World War II memorabilia. Well, we get tired of one thing. Tracks. There's lots of trains leaving, but rarely ones coming back. We get tired of counting trains, tired of counting trains. She smiles. Strictly high fashion. We fly paper aeroplanes. Never worry about crashing. We get tired of flying planes. Tired of flying planes. She smiles. smile for my wife to show me the magic love brings. My name is King Midas. I married Mona Lisa.
I may not have heard that song in 20 years. Yeah. I remember it from way back in
the
day.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, that's yeah. Great.
It's on the new record, and we've got this great pedal steel player underneath it. Yes.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, my guest has been Jefferson Barry, his new record for the Urban Acoustic Coalition. Please pick it up at all the places we talked about. Come see his show. Get in contact with him. He would love to hear from you. Stories from back in the day. Maybe he's got a tip on where to get those mountains of cocaine. 1981 is where you get those.
Thank you so much, Adam.
This was a blast, man. I'm so glad you came in.
Thank you so much. This was a
pleasure. So, ladies and gentlemen, this has been Rhymes Against Humanity. I will take us out with a little bit of the girl I like is a piece of that chick I take next chance. Thank you very much, Jefferson.
Great.
And we are clear.